What's up, everybody? Welcome to the podcast. It's Friday. We're going to be talking about financial tips today on this very Friday. And today I am joined by Concise Connor on our team, who is a student loan expert, also financial planner, certified financial planner, and your day-to-day involves working in the investment space, right? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I work on our investment models, the procedures that we have to accomplish various things for clients so that we're saving as much as we possibly can in taxes and making sure we're diversified and invested in the right things. Yeah, so very hands-on in our investment work.
Nice. Yeah. And I call you Concise Connor to remind you to keep things less technical. I have to do that. Actually, you're not as bad. Travis, I have to do that with constantly because Travis loves to get technical. So, and if you're a client, we've got these quarterly like investment meetings that we do, and we kind of have them duel it out, technical Travis and Concise Connor, to bring it back down to like regular speak. So it's pretty fun. But investing, right? So investing can be somewhat intimidating as you're getting started. But today we're going to chat about how tax advantaged accounts can really help student loan borrowers in different ways, right? In taxes and retirement savings and savings in general. So we're going to get down to some basic stuff to start, but I'm sure just because of us and our nerdiness, we will drill down into some technicalities a little bit, but still keep it high level enough to give you a good idea of where you can get started and what buckets you should be considering contributing to be productive, proactive in your financial plan. So I was thinking we could start with, of course, work with a lot of student loan borrowers. So we preach a lot about contributing to pre-tax buckets. And pre-tax is money that's going in to your employer account or into a certain account that's not taxed today. So tell me a little bit about some pre-tax buckets or common pre-tax buckets, and then we'll talk about why you should be considering contributing to these and the nuts and bolts.
Yeah, well, the most common one that most folks are going to be familiar with is your employer plan. So if you have a 401k, 403b, there's various ones, right? TSP if you're a federal employee. If you have one of those available at work, those are ordinarily pre-tax. You may have a Roth option as well, but by default, they're pre-tax. And that's a big pot to save into. $23,000 is your contribution limit as the employee. That doesn't include your employer match. So they can add on top of that. So big bucket to put a lot of money away.
I think 401k, 403b, 401a, 457, there's a lot of fours, right? And then if you're a federal employee, TSP, if you're at a smaller practice, there's like simple IRA or SEP IRA. You can also have a solo 401k. So what we're saying here is there is no excuse to not contribute to something because there's some type of vehicle that we could open that's pre-tax to start saving for retirement. And we look at it as a win-win-win. So not just a win-win, but a win-win-win. Say that five times fast.
Win-win-win. Yeah.
But in these accounts, we're saving for our future self, right? Which is super important for our student loan borrowers because we already have an extra tax on our income, and that is your student loan payment. So we have to be even more intentional about setting our future self up for success and saving early for retirement, because we may not be able to save as much early on if we've got a student loan payment in the mix as well. But it's saving for our future self. Pre-tax buckets reduce our taxes today because we're deferring that income until later. So we don't have to pay taxes on it today. We pay taxes on it when we take the money out later on. The huge benefit here too is it reduces your student loan payment. Because pre-tax contributions, it hides that income until later. So we're not taxed on that today. And your income-driven repayment plan, if you're on an income-driven repayment plan, is going to be based off of that lower adjusted gross income after you've made those contributions.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy, right? Like, let's say you want to save money just in a taxable brokerage account. Your employer pays you $100. Of that $100, maybe only $70 of that hits your brokerage account that you can actually save. But if you're saving pre-tax, every dollar of it goes. You're not paying federal taxes, state taxes. You're not making your IDR payments. Also, well, I'm a huge investment nerd, so the way that I think about the student loan savings, yes, your payments go down the very next year after having saved into one of these accounts. But it's kind of like the US stock market averages 10% a year. You get a 10% savings on your student loan payment for every dollar you put in your 401k or 403b. So it's kind of like you got the US stock market's return for free immediately. as soon as you put your money in your workplace plan, right? It's like, that's great. You get, it's like 1 year free.
Yeah, that's kind of a nice creative way to think about it too. And matches. So matching is something that comes up a lot in our student loan consultations. Like we'll ask when we're going through and we're running the numbers for what somebody's student loan plan is going to look like, we have to know income, but most people know their gross income, you know, how much they're getting paid for their salary. But then the next question is, okay, well, how much do you contribute to 401k or TSP or whatever account? And then we subtract that out to get the adjusted gross income. And then almost always what people will say is, oh, well, my match is 3%. And that's actually not the question we're asking when we're asking, like, how much are you contributing to your 401k? But I think people are kind of trained in that lingo because a match is what your employer will contribute if you're contributing. And matches depends on every employer, right? Your employer could give you 3% just for being an employee. That just means like if you're an employee, they give you 3% into your 401k. So it's kind of like an extra income boost there going into retirement. But other companies or entities will say, well, you have to contribute 3% for me to contribute 3% as the employer. And so folks will almost always just at least get up to the match to get that matched amount. And so when we ask, you know, how much are you contributing towards retirement? It's not necessarily like, you know, how much are we matching? I mean, that might be what you're doing, but just remember and know that you've got a much bigger bucket that you can contribute to. Like you said earlier, Connor, you can have up to 23,000 as of this year, 2024, to contribute to an employer account. And the match is great. It's going to go towards your retirement too, but it actually doesn't reduce your adjusted gross income. So if you're only doing 3% because that's what your employer matches, great, we're getting the match. That is a good positive. So that, don't get me wrong, like that's great that we're doing that. But also keep in mind that we can save more. And the more we save, the more it reduces your adjusted gross income, which reduces your taxable income and reduces your student loan payment. And of course, increases how much we have going towards retirement, right? So
yep. You get to pay future you for retirement or pay the IRS and the Department of Ed more, and we like you better. Can we talk about self-employed plans? Because I imagine
yes.
One or two or 100 people listening to this might be in a position where they're self-employed either by themselves or maybe they run their own business.
Yes. You're not out of luck. You've got options too. So tell us about those options, Connor.
Yeah. Maybe even more options. So
right.
if you're a sole business owner, let's say you do 1099 work, right? Maybe you have an S corp or just a sole proprietor, single member LLC. You have a couple options available to you. You can use a SEP IRA or a solo 401k, both of which are pre-tax. You could maybe set up a simple. That's pretty rare though.
Yeah, more rare. It was very popular in the vet space, but not as much anymore. They're not as simple as they once were.
Wink, ding. So SEP IRA and solo case, you have a huge contribution limit when you're self-employed. So remember, if you're working W-2, you can put $23,000 in your employer plan, most employer plans. And then your employer contributes on top of that. Well, when you're self-employed, you can make both employee and employer contributions in a solo 401k. So you have that same $23,000 limit as the employee, but hey, you're also the employer. You're the one doing the match. And maybe you're thinking you're a pretty generous employer to your only employee this year. And so you can match up to $46,000 extra on top of your 23 as the employee. That's in a solo K. Now, SEP IRAs are used a little bit less frequently, but they are a little bit easier to set up. They only get the employer portion of the solo 401k, if you want to think about it like that. But you have the same contribution limit. It's a total of $69,000. And remember that all these accounts are pooled too.
So yeah, contributing to these as a sole proprietor or a business owner, man, you could go and brag to all your friends like, man, my employer is the best. They give me $69,000 into my retirement accounts. It's you, right? So be a good employer to yourself. But also to put this on steroids too, I want to mention a lot of folks, they'll have maybe a W-2 job, like a lot of the physicians we work with or dentists we work with, even vets will have a W-2 job, but you'll also have some moonlighting or some 1099 income, like contractor income on the side. And the cool news here is we can utilize our employer account. Like if we have a 401k at one of those employers or 403b, we can still contribute to that up to the employee match, the 23,000. And we can also open, let's say, a solo 401k, maybe even a SEP IRA for that 1099 income. And again, it is pooled. So just like you said, the employee side is pooled, meaning we can only contribute up to the 23,000 as the employee. So you might as well just do that through your W-2 job, since it's on, you could do that through your payroll, but you can contribute more as the employer. And that's pretty cool, because then you've got the best of both worlds, where you've got, you know, your employer account through work, the W-2 job, and you have your own account that you control, you manage, and you can contribute to as you make more income with that 1099 income in the future. So on steroids.
Yeah, self-employed, you have so many options. Also, it's important to note there's probably a large number of folks who run perhaps a business that has employees. Maybe you run a dental practice. There's a number of options, right? But at that point, you can set up a couple different kinds of plans. I would encourage you to look into 401ks, explore 401ks. And the common logic for business owners has been, oh, 401ks are expensive, right? There's administrative fees. Yeah, it's complicated. There's documents that you got to sign up for. There's liability on the company side. But there's actually something passed a couple years ago called the Secure Act that gives you credits to start a 401k plan. So going back to that example, let's say you're a dentist running your own practice. You have a couple staff. There's a possibility that you may be able to set up a 401k plan and for the first couple of years, pay very little or nothing in fees, very little in fees. Then you get the big contribution limits as opposed to other employer plans that are not as nice to save on your income-driven loan payments.
Yeah. So we're talking a lot about pre-tax right now. So that's the tax advantage here. We're going to talk about post-tax here in a minute, and then taxable towards the end. But pre-tax really helps our student loan borrowers who are going towards loan forgiveness and who are wanting to save on taxes today. Because all of this that you're contributing to your future self for retirement, it's going to be reducing our taxable income, which in turn reduces our student loan payment, which many of our professionals are going towards either PSLF or the long-term income-driven repayment forgiveness. And so we get that question all the time, like, well, how do I get my payment down? You know, how do I reduce my payment? Well, one way is to contribute to these pre-tax vehicles. And I'm telling you, like, retirement is going to be, you think your student loan bill and your student loan plan is expensive. Retirement is going to be more expensive. So let's get moving on saving in that bucket. Really prioritize that. We can also be saving. So another pre-tax bucket that's not retirement related is an HSA or an FSA. So HSA stands for Health Savings Account, an FSA Flex Savings Account. This is something that you might have access to with your employer through your employer benefits if they offer health insurance. If we have a high deductible healthcare plan, we have access to an HSA. We can contribute to this for health-related expenses. FSA, we usually don't have access to both, but one or the other. So FSA is another like savings account for health-related expenses. And kind of a piggyback on FSA, there's also FSA dependent care, which helps set money aside pre-tax, you know, before taxes, to go into this account for paying for childcare expenses if you and your spouse work, or if you're a single parent and you work and you're paying for childcare. So tell me a little bit more about these guys, because they are pre-tax, but obviously a little different than retirement, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Oh, I get so excited about talking about HSAs. So we have a national parks trip planned pretty soon, and we did a couple this year. And I have Lucy sitting right behind me, my black lab. So this is what made me think of this. I think of HSA as like, have you seen those videos online, like folks living in Montana or out by big national parks where their dog barks at a bear and like scares a bear off their territory?
Oh, yeah.
Away from their house. It's kind of like, I'd be terrified as a dog owner, right?
Yeah.
That's how I think about an HSA. An HSA is like a chihuahua that like scares off a bear. It's like this, like right. You don't have a big contribution limit. You don't have all the space that you have to save a 401k or a solo 401k, but it's so powerful because with an HSA, you can do some tricky things and never pay taxes on that money ever. So yeah, we don't have to get, well, we can get a little bit into it, but
yeah. Well, HSAs too. Like, I think HSAs, like, do you believe in unicorns, Connor? Because An HSA is a unicorn, right?
Yeah.
It is never taxed. Do you hate taxes? Does anyone listening to this hate taxes? Well, yeah, all of us do. HSAs are literally the only bucket you can contribute to that are completely tax-free if you use the funds correctly. So they're for health-related expenses, and they're for things that are out of pocket. So you can't use them to pay for your health insurance premiums necessarily, but you can use it for like co-pays or prescriptions. There's a list of things like sometimes sunscreen or like, I don't think you could do over-the-counter like Advil or ibuprofen or anything anymore, but there's like a list of things that you can purchase at like Walgreens that would qualify for use in this HSA account. So that's one way you could use it is like on an ongoing basis, you reimburse yourself, or sometimes these HSA companies will have debit cards that pull straight from this account for qualifying expenses that you can use to pay for those things. And so it's pre-tax when it goes in the account, right? And it can be invested. So you can have it growing for you, depending on what you have it invested in. And if you spend the money on eligible things, qualifying things, it's completely tax-free. So we saved on taxes. We probably had some growth on that money because it sat there invested, but we're not having to pay taxes on any of it. That's why it's a unicorn. It's hidden money for those health-related expenses. I think one of our other partners, Sim, she'll tell you all about HSAs at any cocktail party. But the cool part is you don't have to use it in the same year that you contribute to it. This is how she uses it. So a financial planner, this is how she uses an HSA and how I'm going to start using mine, where basically, you know, if you can cash flow some of your healthcare expenses, like you've got a good savings rate, you're contributing to retirement, budget-wise, you can handle like paying copays or things out of pocket, go ahead and do that. Still contribute to your HSA and let that account grow. But what you do is save those receipts, save them, because there is no limit on when you can reimburse yourself. So if you make the purchase this year for a copay that's $100, you can reimburse yourself for that 10 years from now, 20 years from now, and it will be tax-free as long as you have the receipt, right, to back it up. So put that in like a Google Drive or somewhere safe, somewhere digital that you will always have access to. But that's what's pretty cool about this is like you can be spending in these areas, but not necessarily reimburse yourself immediately. But it's kind of like a backup emergency account for like, even if it's not medical expense related at that time, but you have a whole laundry list of expenses that you've spent on over the years that you can add up to that expense amount. Like you can still pull that money out tax-free because you didn't pull it out at the time. Am I explaining that in a way that makes sense, Connor?
Yeah, absolutely. Is that the message with HSAs? Gotta have the receipts.
Yeah, gotta have the receipts. Yeah, back it up.
Yeah, it's so, so powerful. And now you can only contribute $4,150. This is in 2024 per person. So if the health plan that you're on covers your family, you can contribute $8,300. So double that individual limit. So again, contribution limit is not nearly as much as a workplace retirement plan. But yeah, but when you don't have taxes ever again, right? No taxes on the growth, no taxes when you pull it out if it's for your qualified medical expenses. That's really, really powerful. You can also even use that for part of your Medicare premiums when you're retired. So it's kind of like a retirement account, right? It's the best retirement account that nobody knows about.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of a sneaky retirement account. And you could literally save in this and have it grow and build over time and use this in retirement. And if you were to take money out and it wasn't for, you didn't have enough medical expenses to add up to what you were taking or whatever the situation, if it wasn't for a qualifying expense, but you were of age for retirement, it's treated like a 401k. So you're just taxed on it as income at that time, which isn't the end of the world. So you could always use it at any point, even if it's not for health related expenses is kind of the point. But if you use it strategically, it's completely tax-free, which is cool.
Yeah.
Now FSAs. Yeah. I was going to say FSAs are slightly
they're
different.
They're a little bit
though,
different.
Right?
Yeah. They're a little bit different. I guess I just wanted to say that the FSA, think about it as like a short-term HSA, like still valuable, right? So in health FSA, you can contribute $3,200 to. You cannot roll it over from year to year though. You might've heard, right? The difference. HSAs roll over, they're your asset. FSA, you use or lose.
Right, which is kind of stinky, but you could still take advantage of it. You just take a look at the list of what is eligible for that FSA, like what you can use it for. Kind of tally up what you think you might spend that year, like when you're enrolling in this, and that's how you can determine how much to contribute. Every employer has some kind of rollover provision. It's either you can roll over up to like $500 of unused funds in the next year, or sometimes there's an extension period. It depends on how the employer set up this FSA account, but make sure you're aware of the rules and just try not to miss out on using the funds, because you will lose those funds, which is yucky.
One thing to be aware of too, the FSAs your employer will provide. You cannot get an FSA anywhere other than your employer. An HSA, if you have a health plan that qualifies, but your employer didn't offer an HSA, it's rare, right? But you can open one up anywhere that you'd like.
Yep, that's true. Yeah, I'm a good example of that. I have a high deductible healthcare plan, me and my husband do. And, you know, it's just on the open market, doesn't have like an HSA specific company tied to it, but I went and opened my own and I can manage it on my own separately. So certainly something that won't limit you if your employer doesn't specifically provide one. But FSA, dependent care, I see this being really popular among parents of younger children because childcare is not cheap, right?
No kidding.
We don't know that life yet, but we know enough to be scared about it.
Yeah, we have only dog children right now.
Yeah, only dog children who you might see in the background if you're watching on YouTube every so often. But dependent care is another like bucket that we contribute to that's pre-tax. We could use the funds for qualifying childcare expenses. So that's like if your kid goes to daycare or you pay a nanny or someone in home. The key is both spouses have to be working. So you can't have an FSA dependent care account and have it be tax-free if you have a stay-at-home spouse. There's some technicalities there, but most of the time if we're spending on childcare, it's because both spouses are working.
Yeah. I mean, think if you have an HSA or an FSA plus a dependent care FSA, you're making like a ton of your expenses each year pre-tax. Like that's pretty cool. Usually you can't deduct healthcare expenses until they hit 7.5% of your AGI, which if you think about it is like a pretty, I don't want to call it catastrophic, but like, that's a serious amount, right? Like you make $100,000 a year. Yeah. You can only deduct medical expenses over $7,500. Like, holy smokes, that's a rough year.
It is. So going into like taxes for a second, it used to be easier to deduct things from your income. You could choose to either take the standard deduction or itemize. And the threshold for the standard deduction recently was raised, where it cut out a lot of people who were itemizing because the standard deduction was high enough to where you didn't even need to do that anymore. And I think they did that because it was a lot of work, right, for the IRS to like look at all these itemized tax returns. So they're trying to make it easier on everyone. And so a lot of people don't quite itemize anymore because we don't have enough to really deduct above that standard deduction limit. And for healthcare expenses, you might be thinking, man, I spent a lot on healthcare last year. I spent X amount of dollars. But if it doesn't go over 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, so that example was perfect. If your AGI was 100,000, your medical expenses had to be over 7,500 before you can even start to deduct those funds, right? So that's a really unfortunate, expensive year if that's the case, if you can deduct those things. But an HSA and an FSA is kind of a caveat around that, where technically you are deducting contributions that you put into that savings account that you could be using for expenses. So it's an easier, more accessible way to kind of make deductions on taxes in that way.
Right. I would also add something to be aware of with HSAs. I've heard clients say before, like, my employer doesn't offer one. Can I have one? Yes. And then do I have to make contributions through payroll? And the answer is no. You can make one-off contributions whenever you'd like. It's not like your workplace plan where it has to be like a percentage of your paycheck every 2 weeks or month. So
very, very
flexible.
Employer provides one, it does have to be like payroll deducted if they have one, if they support or sponsor one. But yeah, otherwise you could do like lump sum contributions. That's what I do. I just wait, you know, until I've got that money saved up, dump it in there, and then that's my contribution for the year. So you could do the same. So we talked about pre-tax stuff, a lot of pre-tax stuff. There's a lot of opportunity for pre-tax. Let's talk about post-tax, good old Roth, right? That came out in the 90s. So in a sense, like Roth is newer on the block. All the pre-tax stuff we just talked about has been around for a while, you know, saving money on taxes today, paying taxes on it later. And then in came in Roth, which is all post-tax savings, which really just have to do mostly with retirement accounts. There's not really Roth anything else except for retirement. So I'll let you take it away to tell us about Roth, Mr. Roth.
Yeah. It's kind of an interesting time too, because you saw recently that you can now have an employer match go to a Roth account. That's brand new.
Brand new. Yes, that was not the case for a very long time.
Roth is post-tax. It's a post-tax contribution where we pay taxes on that money this year. We don't get to deduct the contribution, but any money in a Roth account grows tax-free forever. So you never pay taxes on the growth. And when you pull it out, you don't pay taxes either. Also, I'd even add, it has a lot of flexibility too. So you can pull your contributions from a Roth account, a cadence that's a lot easier than your traditional, your pre-tax 401k or IRA. They're a lot more flexible.
Yeah, there's more stringent rules around like pre-tax, like when you can take money out. Like things have to be pretty catastrophic, like a really bad financial hardship to be able to take money out, or you have to be separated from service, and you also have to take the tax hit when you take the money out, which is pretty yucky. And there's like a 10% penalty if you're under age, under 59 and a half. Where Roth is a little different. Roth, there's some technicalities there depending on if it's a Roth IRA or an employer account, but it is a little more flexible, which is good. So the downsides to it, I guess, post-tax, right? So we don't save on taxes today by contributing to this, but that might be okay. Let's think about like a scenario where a Roth might make a lot of sense in like your career, like thinking about your income trajectory. So if you're making the lowest amount of income you're ever going to make right now, because you're at the very starting stage of your career, this might be an interesting, good time to potentially consider a Roth, because we're paying the least amount of taxes that we probably will. And later on in life, like when our higher income is in the higher tax brackets, like that might be where we want to save more on taxes and the pre-tax is more attractive. So you can kind of pull these different levers on when to contribute where. The stinky part about Roth is it's not going to help us on our student loan payments, though, because it's post-tax, so it's not going to reduce our income. But it's really attractive that we're taxed today and we're never taxed on it again, including the Roth, because we all hate taxes, right? So we never have to think about taxes again with a Roth account. You think about planning, too. I think a three-legged stool, right? Maybe explain that concept when it comes to thinking about where we should be putting money for retirement and savings.
Yeah, that's such a good analogy. When you look forward, let's think about you in retirement, and you've done the fantastic job at saving, you're student loan free, and you've got these pots of money that you've saved up, right? One is pre-tax, one is post-tax, your Roth, and then one is taxable. So let's say that's like a brokerage account. All three of those are taxed differently, right? Pre-tax, you pay income taxes, Roth, you pay nothing, and your taxable account, you pay capital gains. And the reason that we want to have something in each of those buckets is that you can use them in a combination such that you could pay zero in taxes. That number you could pay, you could get up to $200,000 a year. This was, I believe, in 2023. So that number may have inflated a little bit, but $200,000 a year to retire on and pay nothing in taxes. If you pulled from the different combination of accounts in the right way, how cool is that?
That is pretty cool. Tell me more. How do you do this?
Yeah, right. Right. How do we pay zero in taxes? You essentially, the money that you're pulling from your pre-tax accounts is taxed as income. It's considered earned income, essentially. And so up to a certain bracket of earned income, you don't pay any capital gains tax, long-term capital gains tax on your brokerage account. So pulling from your brokerage account, realizing gains, costs you nothing, is zero. And then your Roth money is also 0% tax. So we fill that up at the end. So we basically, you're taking your pre-tax money, you're drawing on that to the extent that you hit the limit for 0% taxes on long-term gains in your brokerage. It's kind of complicated, but the theme of it is if we have some money in all three of those buckets, it's really, really beneficial. We don't want to be, we'll always be a little bit lopsided to one or the other generally.
Right.
But it's, you know, we want to have a little bit of a balance if we can.
Yeah. So this kind of gets into like the point of like, why are we saving in these buckets? Well, duh, it's for retirement, but it's also for like options, like having options for your distribution strategy, because no one likes to have just one option, like being backed into a corner with one way. And we also don't know what the economy is going to look like in the future, what tax brackets are going to look like later on. We don't know how long you want to work. You know, you might think you only want to work until you're 50, but maybe you want to work longer, or vice versa. Maybe we think we're going to work until we're 65, but we actually want to retire at 50 when we get there, 50, 55. So we need options to be able to pivot in different market environments or different life situations. So that's really the whole point of this three-legged stool, is having money in different buckets that give us options. So there's not really one way is the highway. Like, not everyone should just be contributing to Roth or just be contributing to pre-tax. That's very unfair to say. It's really more so we need to be doing all of it to an extent, right? We need to balance contributing to each of these buckets over time. And that's kind of the beauty of planning, is like, how much towards each of these buckets, and what is our plan? Like, later on, you know, what is our distribution strategy when we're going to retire? Where do we pull money from? So that's a little along down the line, but why it's so important to be talking about each of these buckets. And we'll talk about taxable buckets here coming up. We didn't quite get there yet. But with Roth, sometimes we'll get the question, because people will hear about Roth and they're like, oh, well, that's great. That's the end all be all. I need to contribute to that. And they'll ask their planner or their student loan consultant about, you know, should I be doing Roth? The question is always, it depends, because we have to decide, like, is it more beneficial for you right now at this stage of your life to do pre-tax? Because the pre-tax is going to reduce our taxes today, and it's going to reduce our student loan payment, which, if your trajectory is student loan forgiveness, we might want to try to maximize that savings as much as possible. And the pre-tax buckets can help us do that. Otherwise, maybe it is time to start doing Roth if we're on a payoff approach with our loans, or if we can kind of split the difference appropriately between pre-tax and post-tax. So that's what goes into, I think, the beauty of planning, is trying to figure out when should we be contributing to these buckets and how much. But there are some cool ideas that we have too, like some strategic ideas that we have to start getting money into Roth early on that don't quite affect your student loan plan yet. But you have to be proactive about it, right? So you had an idea, I'll let you kind of dive into it, but about contributing kind of earlier on in your career towards Roth, but also maybe strategically using like tax deadlines to contributing to Roth. So share a little bit about that.
Yeah. So again, I would reiterate what Megan said. Early in your career, maybe it makes sense to contribute to Roth while your tax rate is a little bit lower. Even if you're on an income-driven plan and you can get around the impact of saving that post-tax money, right? And having maybe a higher AGI in 1 year, you can get around that being considered on in your student loan payments. So let's like think through an example, like you're, you know, maybe a physician in residency and your income's a little bit lower, but we know it's going to go up. You want to save on your student loan payments if we can, but we want to get a little bit of money in Roth while our income is lower, right? Accept our current tax rate and put that money away for no taxes ever again. What you can do, let's say if your recertification date for your student loans is in between like late May to mid November, right? Somewhere in that time frame, then this could work. So let's say it's 2024. Let's treat 2024 as the year that you do Roth contributions, right? So now our 2024 taxable income shows higher because we didn't get to deduct those contributions like a pre-tax account. But when we go to recertify, let's say we recertify in June every year. When we go to recertify our student loan payment next year, so it's now 2025, what we'll do is we'll just file an extension for 24's taxes and we'll certify based on 23's, right? It's the most recent tax return we have available. You can file an extension on your taxes all the way to October. So you've extended, you've certified based on 23's income. Now let's fast forward a year. Let's say 25, you go back to your pre-tax contributions. We've done our Roth year. It's now 2026. We have to recertify income again. Well, this year, we'll just file taxes on time, right, for 2025. And then you update income based on 25's taxes. So you've gone from 23 to 25. You skip 24 altogether. So you can have a Roth year. It sounds like a cheat year.
Yeah, it is kind of a cheat year.
You're having your cake and eating it too, right?
Yeah, it is. And it's, I think that's the beauty of like strategy, working with folks that know the student loan game, but also like the tax and the financial planning game, because all of these things work together one way or another. They're all like, or they will be, whether or not you know it or not, you know, whether or not you realize it, they're communicating. All of these pieces and parts to your financial plan are somehow affecting one another. So if we can take advantage of how they're affecting each other and strategically time things to be in your favor, like that can save us money on taxes, on student loan payments, save us time, things like that. So that's pretty cool that you'd have to like proactively be thinking about, okay, I'm going to extend my tax filing this year because when I have to recertify later this year, I want it to be off of my re most recent tax return, which is going to be not this year, but last year, because I'm not filing. And an extension, that's just like a, hey, IRS, like here's my draft of my return, but I'm not done. I'm going to come back and file this later, which is totally allowable. The only thing you want to be careful about is if you owe taxes, if you know that you're going to owe because you're like a 1099 contractor or something, or you underpaid for the year, you just need to make sure that you pay on time. You still have to pay. It's not a deferral on when you have to pay, but it is a deferral on when you have to actually file and submit your final return.
Right. Like going to your professor at school and saying, like, hey, I'm not going to turn in my paper now. I'm going to turn it in 6 months from now. And
Yeah,
they're like, please
when
show
I'm
us that
ready.
you've done something. And you say,
Yeah.
okay, fine. Here's the couple words I've typed up.
Right, exactly. So, pretty cool ways that we can kind of integrate our retirement savings strategy with pre and post-tax, like kind of deciding between that and then integrate that in with our student loan plan. One quick account we'll mention before we go into taxable accounts, and then we'll wrap things up. But 529s. So 529, you might have heard this before if you've got kiddos and you're planning on saving for education for them, right? You've got student loans today. You want to help them not have student loans in the future. So a 529 bucket could be a great bucket to use. It is pre-tax to an extent. We don't get a deduction on the federal tax side of things, but we do on the state tax side of things when we contribute to these. We can deduct some of the state taxes that we would have to pay for contributing to a 529, which is pretty cool. But a 529, if we pull money out in the future for education expenses, it is tax-free at that point. So it's a really nice bucket for education savings. Doesn't really impact the federal state tax, doesn't reduce your student loan payment if you contribute to them, but it does help you save on the state taxes if you're in a state that has taxes. I know my like Texas people are like, ugh. Or my Tennessee people or Florida people. They're like, dang it.
I feel the pain here in Illinois.
Yeah.
I mean, a 529 is basically like a Roth for education, right?
Yeah. It's a cool bucket. And a lot of people's goals are to save for education. So, one quick reminder, like, your retirement is first priority. That's what your planner would probably say too, but that is a great bucket to be contributing to if we've got retirement on track and we want to make sure our kids are on track for their schooling. But any other things you want to mention on that before we talk about taxable accounts?
Yeah, I like that idea. I like when you're on the airplane, put your mask on first and then help those next to you.
Yeah, it's because I mean, as you know, as a student loan borrower, you could borrow for school, but retirement is going to be your biggest financial bill ever, and you're not going to be able to borrow for retirement, unfortunately. Hopefully, never. Hopefully, that's never a thing. But all right, well, let's round things out with that third stool, like, the leg of the stool. So we did pre-tax, post-tax. Now let's chat about taxable, which taxable just means that there's not any tax benefit to contributing to these accounts, but there are still things that we could do to reduce taxes on how much we have to pay in these vehicles, right? So, taxable accounts, think about like your high yield savings account. Think about a non-retirement investment account. It has growth in it, hopefully, every year. If we're invested, we're diversified, we're growing that account over time. And what do you know? That growth is taxable to you, right? Which stinks, but it's not taxable as bad as you would think, right? If we use the funds within a year, it will be taxed as income. So if we put $1,000 in an account, it grows to $1,300. We pull it out in 6 months. We will be taxed on that $300 difference as if we earn that as income. That's short-term capital gains. But if we left that money in that account longer term, more than 12 months, then we've got a more favorable tax rate on that, right? You want to share a little bit more about what that means?
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit, but with investing past a year in a taxable account, you get long-term capital gains rates, which are much, much nicer than income rates. So if you're in the lowest two tax brackets, you pay 0% on your long-term capital gains. All the tax brackets after that until the highest one are at 15%, and then the highest one's at 20%. So the max you could pay on long-term capital gains is 20% if you're in the top tax bracket.
So people get like scared about taxable accounts, but the tax rates are lower. I'd rather pay even 20% versus an income tax rate in the future. Most folks are going to be in that 15% tax rate for capital gains. but it's still tax. So we're still going to hate it no matter what. So what can we do to reduce tax on growth in these types of accounts?
There's a couple of things you can do. One, we like to call IDR sensitive investing, right? Income driven repayment sensitive. That's taking into account that, hey, we have an extra 10% income tax. So your investment income on a taxable brokerage account or your interest, like Megan said, from a high yield savings account, those are included in your student loan calculation for income. So we pay a 10% tax on those. So what we'd like to do is those investments that generate more tax consequences for you, think your high dividend paying companies, stock and dividend payers, international companies tend to pay higher dividends as well, or international funds, investment funds, those sorts of things. You still want to be invested in them. They're great investments, but you want to make sure you hold them in the right account. And in your taxable investment account, you may want to hold the things that are more tax efficient, right? That don't pay as much in dividends or don't have as many tax consequences each year. We want those growing in your brokerage account.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like the things that are spitting off like a lot of growth, like a lot of dividends or interest, like, you know, if they're in our retirement accounts, then that's deferred, right? We don't have to pay tax on that until we go to retire, if it's in a pre-tax account, or ever if it's a post-tax, you know, account, a Roth. So it's smart to be aware of like what kinds of investments we have in our retirement account. You know, the account is one thing, but what we're invested in is the bigger part of that thing. So it can be smart, because otherwise, if it's in our taxable account, we could be paying, you know, of course, the growth is great, but we also want tax efficient growth in our taxable accounts, because we're going to have to pay taxes on it today or now soon. So that's a good point that I think sometimes folks kind of, they don't know about or don't think about, is like the allocation of how the accounts are invested really does matter. And what guts are in that account matters.
Yeah. I've worked with a lot of clients who do, they just split their account very simply. They have it at Vanguard. They do 50%, you know, total US stock market, 50% or whatever percent international, and that's their brokerage account. That's okay. That's a fantastic place to start. Don't get me wrong. But if you just tilted some of those things, right? If we moved a little bit of that international to, like you were saying, a retirement account, pre-tax or post-tax, and had a little bit more US in your brokerage account, that saves you a ton of money in taxes. It really does. Like 1/3 of the dividend yield on your international fund that you have in your brokerage account disappears for taxes, roughly, maybe even a little bit more.
Yeah. And this is not advice, guys. Don't go and like allocate how we're talking about right now. We don't know your situation, but this is just an example.
Right. Things to keep in mind. Yep.
Yeah, but things to keep in mind and what us planners like look at when we're looking at your investments. It's not just like, you know, what did it do today or what did it do like recently? It's like, what is it doing in conjunction with the whole picture? What is the whole picture of everything that we're looking at? Cool. And I know tax loss harvesting is another way that we could save money on capital gains taxes. That's something that I think is really fascinating, but also something that it's a little more high maintenance, like if you're doing it as a borrower yourself. But tell me a little bit about tax loss harvesting.
Yeah, I agree. It's a little bit higher touch, right? It's like mechanically a little bit more challenging. So in your brokerage account, let's say part of your investments goes down 1 year. Let's say like maybe US has a bad market year and your US total US stock fund goes down a bit and it's now sitting at a loss in your account and you're checking and you're like, oh no, this stinks. But you know, you can actually take advantage of that, because when you sell something in your taxable brokerage account, you realize that loss, you make it real, loss or gain. And if it's a loss, you can use that loss on your taxes. There's like a checklist that you need to make sure that you check off with any of these losses, but then you get to use them, right? You get to use them against other gains. Or if you don't have other gains that year, you can write $3,000 of tax losses, basically investment losses, off against your income, which is such a huge value, right? And that lowers your student loan payments as well.
Yeah. Well, and so the goal is not, of course, to lose money in these accounts, but it's going to inevitably happen at some point, right? The market ebbs and flows. Every stock, every fund will have some kind of dip or some kind of correction. And so if there's a chance to take advantage of it, to go ahead and capture that loss and use it for our benefit, but also stay invested. I think that's the key, is we stay invested. We go purchase something similar, not exactly the same, but similar. And that way we're still like in the market, moving along that escalator, right? Going up. but we're taking advantage of the small dip that it had, and we're using it to our advantage when it comes to taxes and writing off either an amount or having it wash up against our gain in that account. So you could do this on your own. I know it is something that you'd have to monitor on a regular basis. So a lot of regular investors, they prefer to delegate it, right? They'll hire an advisor or a brokerage firm to do this for them. That's something that, you know, the planners that we work with do. But very interesting, very added tax benefit that maybe one might not think about at first when they're thinking about being tax efficient with investing. Well, cool. Any last words there on taxable accounts before we wrap things up?
With that flexibility of being able to access your money all the time, there's a lot that you can do to minimize taxes on taxable accounts. They are by far the trickiest.
If you're thinking early retirement, if you're thinking, I'm going to sell a practice in the future, I'm going to sell an appreciated home in the future, having a brokerage account and investing in that, having access to it at any point is a huge benefit. That's why we have that third leg of the stool. But we can be really smart about how we use it to really reduce the things that we're building on those other two stools. And just in life, like if we have a practice we're selling, we can really kind of hoard some losses to count against that potential future, hopefully huge gain that you have when you're selling a practice or selling a home, you know?
Yep.
Well, we'll definitely drill down into each of these different topics at another time, getting more granular as we go along. But I think this is a great introduction to the different taxable or tax advantaged accounts, I should say, that are out there, what we could use to start to pull our plan together. Thanks for joining me, Connor, on this journey and being concise.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We'll see you in a future one, and join us for Fridays on these financial tips that we're going to be bringing to you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
This podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered individualized investment advice. If a specific investment is mentioned, do not consider it a recommendation to buy or sell the investment. Seek first advice from a financial professional before implementing any strategies discussed. All investments involve risk, and past performance does not guarantee future results. Yay, compliance.